Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Risk Map Podcast, produced by Control Risks, the global political integrity and security risk consultancy. In this edition, we look ahead to the weeks that straddle April and May of 2015. I'm Michael Moran, Managing Director for Global Risk Analysis in New York.
And in London, I'm Charles Hecker, Control Risks Global Research Director. Welcome to the podcast.
Well, in this edition, Kazakhstan, which has known only one leader in its post-Soviet history, holds a snap presidential election. On the other side of Europe, a UK general election should provide a stark contrast with Labour and the Tories running neck and neck. But first to the United States, where the leaders of the world's first and third largest economies meet on 28th April.
Mike, of course, you're referring to the United States and Japan. Recently, there's been a lot of concern over maritime disputes between Japan and China. And of course, it's the U.S. 7th Fleet that has Japan's back through a mutual defense treaty. But what about economic ties? That's what Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe will be focusing on in Washington, particularly the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. I'm joined today by Jonathan Buss, senior economist in the global macroeconomic practice at our joint venture partner, Oxford Economics. Jonathan, tell me, what is the precise content of the TPP and why is this important to the international business community?
The Trans-Pacific Partnership is a proposed international economic treaty between countries in the Pacific Rim. So 12 countries are currently participating in the talks, representing about 40% of the global economy, but the US and Japan are overwhelmingly the most important current participants. We don't actually know that much about the details of the proposed agreements because the content of the talks are meant to be confidential until a deal is reached. However, it's generally understood that the TPP mostly focuses on issues relating to things like international enforcement of intellectual property rights and investor-state arbitration rather than trade policy as traditionally understood. Now, the economic benefits of TPP could potentially be substantial. Such an agreement should make cross-border investments in the region easier by harmonizing rules and by increasing investor protection. And indeed, the economic benefits are probably bigger for Japan than for the US. Japan's productivity performance in recent years has been sluggish, and a dose of foreign investment and foreign competition could help turn that around. In many ways, however, the economic aspect of the deal is arguably less important than the strategic and geopolitical aspects. The elephant in the room during the TPP talks has been the rise of China as a global economic power and increasingly a regional political and military power. And this has been manifested recently in China taking the lead in developing alternative international economic institutions independent of the traditional powers in the Pacific Rim, namely the US and Japan. For example, China has recently been pushing the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, which was established under its auspices, and China is also soon to launch its own international payment system. So the TPP talks can, to a large extent, be understood as the US and Japan trying to steal a march on China and establish the ground rules for trade and investment in the region before China beats them to it. And so, from this perspective, the success or otherwise of TPP has a bearing on whether, over the course of the next couple of decades, the economy of the Pacific Rim plays according to US-Japan devised rules or according to China devised rules. Now, US-Japan-led economic order in the Pacific Rim is likely to look quite different to a China-led one. China would undoubtedly prefer a set of international rules that would allow more scope for trade barriers, that allows a greater degree of regulation of capital flows and currencies, and which would tilt the balance of power more towards states than companies. A successful conclusion to the TPP talks would go some way to heading off such an outcome and clearing the ground for a more liberal international economic framework in the region.
Jonathan, can you tell me, what do you think the major risks are to an agreement between President Obama and Prime Minister Abe?
Well, negotiations have been dragging on since 2005, but there is now a sense that with the Obama-Abe talks, we are finally nearing the endgame of discussions on the TPP. The outlook for a prompt conclusion of negotiations does now look quite promising. Both Obama and Abe have done a good job of selling TPP domestically, but there do remain some risks to a smooth conclusion of an agreement, and they mostly relate to internal US politics. So a crucial question is whether Obama will succeed in persuading Congress to give him fast-track powers of negotiation. Now, these if passed, would force Congress to take a yes or no vote on TPP and would strip them of the ability to propose amendments to the deal. Now, this fast-track legislation has cleared a number of hurdles in congressional committees, but it still could fall at the voting stage if left-wing Democratic opposition is strong, or alternatively, if Republican support fades, perhaps over the issue of currency manipulation. Now, if Obama fails to get this fast-track authority that he's looking for, then the deal would still probably be cobbled together, but it could well include a number of amendments that would water down much of the liberal tone of the agreements, perhaps clauses incorporating labour and environmental protections or penalising countries deemed to be interfering in currency markets.
Jonathan Buss of Oxford Economics, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, thanks, Chuck. The giant Central Asian Republic of Kazakhstan has changed its capital from Almaty to Astana since winning independence from the USSR. Its economic profile has changed from a Soviet backwater to an important player on international energy and commodity markets. But it hasn't changed rulers since Nursultan Nazarbayev became first secretary of the Kazakh Communist Party in 1989. Now Nazarbayev has called snap presidential elections, putting him in line for a fifth term, by far the most of any post-Soviet leader. I'm joined by Anna Walker, Control Risk's head of analysis, Europe and CIS. Anna, what explains Nazarbayev's staying power, and is he likely to be staying longer?
As you said, Nazarbayev is Kazakhstan's sole leader since independence, and we certainly see him winning yet another term in the election on the 26th of April. It's actually no surprise that he called this early election. The election was due to be held next year, but as we've seen in previous rounds of elections, Nazarbayev has typically called one early, in a sense, to catch people off guard. Now, Nazarbayev genuinely enjoys a significant degree of popularity within Kazakhstan, and that's largely because of his success in maintaining stability, both economically and politically, particularly when you compare Kazakhstan with its neighbours like Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. Nazarbayev is likely to have won the election anyway. He is facing two challengers, but these are both very unlikely to get a significant share of the vote. If we look back to 2011, Nazarbayev won 96%, and I think we're likely to see a similar share this time round. Now, the reason he's called this election early is because of Kazakhstan's mounting economic problems.
So Kazakhstan, I would imagine, is suffering from the same problems that other energy exporting states are right now, with oil below $50 per barrel.
That's right. Kazakhstan's major resource is oil and gas, and it's very much dependent on export and budget revenue from that sector. But the drop from above $100 a barrel to around $50 a barrel has really hit it hard. We saw economic growth of just 4.3% in 2014, which is obviously higher than many developed economies. But for somewhere like Kazakhstan, which has got used to growth rates of about 7%, that's really very difficult. It's also suffered because of the slowdown in Russia, one of its main economic partners. And that's meant that Kazakhstan has become increasingly less competitive when compared with Russia. And I think we're really likely to see another currency devaluation after the election as the authorities try to make Kazakhstan more competitive as an exporter.
Thanks, Anna.
Thank you.
Mike, the United Kingdom holds a tightly fought general election on the 7th of May, and it has the potential to be a historic moment, something different from the kind of politics that has dominated the United Kingdom since the end of the Cold War. In the first place, the Scottish Nationalists, the SNP, are surging, challenging not only the future of the United Kingdom, but also Labour's traditional primacy in Scotland. And the Tories, the Conservative Party, while polling just as well as their Labour rivals, may not be able to line up coalition partners to continue Prime Minister Cameron's tenure. Joining me here in our London office is Dave Lee, our senior Western Europe analyst. Dave, this is peak politics for the United Kingdom, and we're looking forward to an election the likes of which we haven't seen in several decades. UK election cycles are mercifully short, but this one's been pretty intense. There's been a lot of discussion about domestic policy this time around, hasn't there?
Yes, that's right. I mean, we can say that election cycles are quite short, but the Scottish referendum, which happened in September last year and was effectively being campaigned for 2.5 years before that, has really lengthened this one out. But if we focus on the Westminster election, the criticism in the first couple of weeks of the campaign was that it was all about policies. It was all about Ed Miliband's kitchen. But after the Labour announcement on removing non-domiciled tax status. That changed the whole tenor of the campaign overnight, and ever since it's been about policy, mostly domestic policy. Foreign policy's barely been involved at all. So what we've seen is a lot of discussion about Labour's plans on tax, on equality, on the NHS, and a lot of Conservative plans on inheritance tax, removing inheritance tax, the re-envisioning of the 1980s Thatcher-era property-owning, share-owning democracy. So those two contrasting views of society have been very much where the campaign's been in the last couple of weeks.
Dave, let me just ask you on the follow-up to domestic policy, is there anything that business has to look for in particular? The markets don't seem to be all that afraid of the elections. Government debt sales don't appear to be all that afraid of the elections. Is there anything that business has to worry about depending upon the outcome on May 7th?
I don't really think so. I think the fact that we're going to get a pretty unstable government and that we may even need another election later this year, possibly next year, I think markets and business have probably priced that in already. I think it's pretty clear that, you know, no stable outcome is coming from this. There are concerns about the possibility of a UK referendum on continued membership of the EU if a Conservative-led government is returned. There are some concerns about changes to the tax regime and a possible less friendly business environment if Labour is leading the government after May 7th. But I think in general, I think the broad centrist pro-business environment that we've seen in the last 20 years under governments of both parties in the UK is going to continue whatever. And I think business is smart enough to realise that.
Dave, what's interesting is in spite of the intensity of the debate and the focus on domestic policy and to a really unprecedented level, the polls have stayed pretty much the same. Is
Absolutely.
Anybody jockeying for leadership here?
No, I mean, the polls have really pretty much swirled around parity between the two major parties ever since the election campaign started. Miliband got a small bump, Labour got a small bump after the non-doms announcement, but really nothing has changed. And it's true lower down as well. You look at the UK Independence Party, fairly steady on 13-14%. The Lib Dems fairly steady on rather less than they got in the last election. So nothing's really moving. So you know, one of the two big parties might try and hit a home run in the last week of the campaign to try and jolt that parity away. But it doesn't seem to be happening to me.
David, I think we're all looking forward to May 7th, and I know that we'll come back to you for some comment. Elections are the end of one process, but they're then the beginning of an attempt to govern, and I think we're going to need your guidance when that comes around. So, Dave, for now, thank you very much. Talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
Well, before we sign off, a few other notable events in the coming fortnight. On Monday, 27 April, a EU-Ukraine summit will be held in Kiev, meeting which will be dominated by Ukraine's fraught economic situation and the fragile ceasefire which pro-Russian forces in its eastern region are observing. Friday, the 1st of May, we'll see China introduce a new bank deposit insurance scheme to protect depositors from default. China's banking system has been a source of concern the last few years. And on Wednesday, 6 May, the World Economic Forum opens its Latin America meeting in Mexico. Well, that's it for this edition of Risk Map Podcast, produced by Control Risks, the global political integrity and security risk consultancy. Our podcast is released every other Friday on iTunes or via the Control Risks website, www.controlrisks.com. Also there, you can read our view of Cuba's removal from the U.S. state sponsor of terrorism list. But for now, and for my colleagues in 36 offices around the world, this is Michael Moran in New York saying goodbye.
And from London, this is Charles Hecker. Thanks very much for tuning in.